From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. President Trump put out an executive order on police reform. We'll break down what's in it and how it compares to bills Congress already has in the works. Plus, senior year of high school means prom, graduation, everything in between. This year, it's virtual prom, virtual graduation, online learning, no campus activities. High school life under the 2020 pandemic lens. It's all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take 2. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for spending part of your Tuesday with us. Coming up.
I would have enjoyed walking up on stage for my grandma or for my parents. They've definitely been there throughout my entire experience of high school.
Yeah, the high school class of 2020 has been dealt a pretty difficult hand, what with the virus and social unrest. In just a few minutes, we're going to hear what's on the minds of some Southern California's class of 2020. That's coming up in about 15 minutes. But we start today with the ongoing conversation about policing and community safety. Now, here's a scenario. You see a homeless person in distress, a drug overdose, or a neighborhood dispute, but you don't want to call the police because a police officer could mean someone gets arrested or even worse. But what if when you called 911, a social worker, mental health professional, or maybe an outreach worker shows up instead of an officer with a gun? Well, that's the idea behind a new proposal coming out of the Los Angeles City Council. KPCC reporter Libby Dinkman has been tracking that and a lot more, including how the city's budget will reflect the public outrage over police violence against Black people. Libby, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, A.
All right. Now, this news is breaking as we speak. What is this crisis response plan the city is proposing?
Yes, it's a new motion from Council President Nury Martinez and Council Members Herb Wesson, Bob Blumenfield, Marquise Harris-Dawson, and Curran Price. And it calls for city and county departments like the LAPD, LASA, and the Department of Mental Health to work together to develop an unarmed model of crisis response that would divert nonviolent calls for service away from LAPD to the appropriate non-law enforcement agencies. So if you see someone who needs help, like you were saying, and they're not hurting anyone, you could call for help and know that there would be a trained service provider to respond instead of a police officer. We're still getting details on the full proposal. It's being officially introduced this afternoon, and it would involve a lot of different moving pieces, including funding that would have to shift around. And at this stage, it's only an idea. But still, it's a pretty remarkable development as we're looking at this sentiment around policing and public funding changing day to day thanks to the overwhelming public outcry over Black men being killed by law enforcement.
Yeah, it sounds like it actually could be pretty concrete action from city leaders. It would be a major win for protesters, it sounds, wouldn't it?
You know, so far, like I said, it's a proposal, but it does sound like a pretty significant move by the council. And it's addressing a problem that we've heard about for years from Black Lives Matter and other organizations. Yesterday, a panel of activist leaders, including Melina Abdullah from Black Lives Matter LA, presented to council committee chairs at City Hall on their proposal to defund the LAPD. That's the activist proposal that's called the People's Budget. And it calls for investing in social services, housing, and mental health care instead of law enforcement. Because advocates for police abolition have long argued that there's this law enforcement mission creep going on, where armed officers get involved in situations where people really need health care or conflict mediation instead. And getting armed officers on the scene can only contribute to police violence sometimes and abuses in communities of color. So here's an example that Black Lives Matter researcher David Turner used from his own life during the presentation at City Council yesterday. He said his parents often had domestic violence disputes, but when cops came, they would just arrest someone, and that really broke up his family. Turner said there should be another way.
What would it look like if instead of police officers coming to take my dad away, or police officers coming to criminalize my mother, right, for her mental health issues, what would it look like, right, if we had mental health workers who came to support that? What would it look like if we had people who cared about the community to do restorative justice work, to heal the harm? I'm blessed to be sitting in front of you a year away from getting my PhD. But there are a lot of people who grew up in a very similar situation that I did who are not here because of that same trauma, because of those same issues. But you all have the power and the ability to make a new Los Angeles, to make a new Los Angeles that protects little black boys like I was, protects little black girls like my sister.
And A, it sounds like that presentation hit home. Herb Wesson credited Black Lives Matter and the People's Budget when he tweeted his announcement about this crisis response proposal today.
Well, and Libby, that's not all. There's been some other movement involving the city budget and how much LA spends on the LAPD.
Yes. You remember a couple weeks ago, there was this surprise announcement from the city council. They were calling for up to $150 million to be sliced off the LAPD's budget and be diverted to programs that would support low-income and Black communities in Los Angeles, places that have been hit especially hard in the COVID-19 pandemic. Soon after that, the mayor hopped on board and said he was looking for a total of $250 million in overall budget cuts to shift over to help Black communities. We still don't know where that other $100 million will come from that Garcetti brought up. Mm-hmm. But today, the council passed a motion, the motion that they brought up a couple weeks ago, directing city analysts to identify $100 to $150 million in cuts to the LAPD's budget. And it is really a big deal, A. It's the first time in recent memory that we've seen city leaders actually work to shrink the LAPD. It's always been a pledge by mayors and council presidents to grow the department. But the measure, at the same time, is not being greeted, you know, with cheers and parades from protesters, because they say it's not a huge cut. $150 million out of a $3.1 billion in overall police spending. This would basically scale back planned increases in police funding for the new fiscal year budget, which starts July 1st. And it's not imposing cuts as deep as many departments are facing under Garcetti's really austere COVID-era budget. Civilian city workers are still facing furloughs, and other department budgets are being chopped down unless an alternate plan can be found to save the city hundreds of millions of dollars that it's missing from tax revenues because of the very serious economic impacts of the virus.
But the plan to cut LAPD's budget, even by $150 million, that's still controversial.
Of course. LAPD Chief Michael Moore told Larry Mantle the proposal would require the elimination of hundreds of positions, and he doesn't know where that would come from. It sounds like a mix of civilian employees and police officers. And the LAPPL, the union that represents uniformed police officers, has been very harsh in responding to these cuts. A statement they released soon after the mayor announced said that Garcetti had apparently lost his dang mind and he needed mental health intervention. They said these funding cuts will directly hurt public safety and put people in danger because of reduced patrols. And, you know, the LAPPL is this really powerful force in Los Angeles politics. Emily Alpert Reyes at the LA Times has done great reporting on this. They've given millions of dollars to city campaigns. If you include independent expenditure committees, which candidates can't directly coordinate with but still support them, it's just been this massive outflow of money. And now there is this greater spotlight on the political influence that the police union has, and that is causing some politicians to back away. David Rue, for example, who's in a tight reelection race against a progressive candidate, Nithya Raman, in the 4th Council District, he returned campaign donations from the LAPPL and says that he won't accept future money from them. So the political calculation for city council, maybe county supervisors, and the mayor is changing as we continue to see the spotlight on police accountability thanks to these ongoing protests, say.
That's KPCC's Libby Denkman. Libby, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, keeping with law enforcement, earlier today, President Trump issued an executive order on police reform in America as a way to address the many protests for change that have swept the country.
These standards will be as high and as strong as there is on earth.
But diving into the details, we wanted to see if they're truly groundbreaking and what activists might make of what he laid out. Here to help us with that, we have Luisa Avilas from the National Network for Safe Communities at John Jay College. Luisa, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Now, we should note that much of what the president outlined is already part of a different bills currently up for consideration in Congress. And one of them is co-authored by L.A.-based Congresswoman Karen Bass. So on first reading of that executive order, is the president making a bold proposal?
No, he's not. I would say that the two most important elements of the president's proposal are included in the Justice and Policing Act, which has already been passed by the House of Representatives, and those are a ban on chokeholds and the creation of a national database to share information around police misconduct. But the order in its entirety is not groundbreaking.
All right, now let's break out some of the ideas that President Trump laid out so we can get your take. First, he talked about tying federal grants to programs that teach best practices to police officers. Now, the president doesn't have power over what is exactly taught, but Luisa, what do you make of this move?
So, I mean, one thing that I think is important to note, right, is that it's the order still retains the discretion within the Department of Justice, right? It says that the DOJ will prioritize agencies that meet these standards, but it doesn't have any teeth, right? And I think the other thing to be conscious of here, right, is that best practices are in many ways loosely defined, right? Use of force best practices are different at local and state and federal levels. They vary around the country. A lot of what are considered best practices are grounded in old data, and what, you know, activists and advocates would say is hasn't kept pace with the times and what we know now about the impact that practices have on communities.
Now, he also talked about creating a national database that tracks officers accused of misconduct. Let's hear him.
Under this executive order, departments will also need a share of information about credible abuses so that officers with significant issues do not simply move from one police department to the next.
We've heard before that is a problem. Sometimes police officers do move from district to district or county to county, and their trail doesn't follow along with them. So I'm wondering if that move maybe could be a step toward making police departments more accountable for the officers they hire.
Sure. Well, right, it probably can't hurt. There are still a lot of challenges with developing that kind of database, right? Credible abuse is a really loose term, and there are a lot of structural challenges around producing accountability when officers are accused of misconduct, and a very, very, very small percentage of officers accused of misconduct are ever actually held to any account. So that raises questions about how useful databases can be. That said, right, it absolutely is problematic that officers that are terminated for abuse by one agency can get rehired, you know, sometimes even in the same state, if not in the same state, in you know, the state next door. So efforts around, you know, curtailing that sort of perpetuation of cycles of abuse by particular officers, you know, is important.
Talking to Luisa Aviles, director of the Group Violence Intervention at the National Network for Safe Communities at John Jay College. President also banned chokeholds by police unless an officer's life is at risk. Many departments, including the LAPD, already banned the use of certain kinds of chokeholds. And according to a review by NPR, chokehold bans were, quote, largely ineffective and subject to lax enforcement. So, Luisa, are chokeholds the problem to focus on here?
Absolutely not, right? Banning chokeholds in circumstances where the officer's life isn't at risk is about as uncontroversial, you know, a reform as we could contemplate at this particular moment in time. It's hard to imagine a groundswell of opposition to such a ban. But to your point, right, some bans exist already in some places. Whether they're effective is very much related to how they're enforced and how that ban is policed internally within agencies. So absolutely, it's not the thing to be focusing on right now.
Another thing, too, the president was very careful to focus strictly on policing and promoting the idea that officers keep communities safe. He largely avoided addressing anything about race at all. What do you make of that move, of avoiding that and highlighting what he highlighted?
You know, I think it is indicative of the ways in which this executive order really fails to respond to what the mass movement in the country is demanding, right? So the protesting going on is very clearly rooted in race, and it's rooted in the lack of legitimacy that law enforcement has in communities of color, particularly Black communities. It's rooted in a lack of trust that's informed by a long history of abuse and violence by police.
So, Louisa, I got to ask you one thing before we go, because we're running out of time. Who is this executive order for, you think?
I think it's for the president's base. I think it reassures the president's supporters that he is fundamentally disinterested in meaningful shifts around a perceived support of law and order.
Louisa Aviles, director of the Group Violence Intervention at the National Network for Safe Communities at John Jay College. Louisa, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Anytime.
All right. In any other year, I mean, any other year, June means doing the graduation walk to grab your diploma for a lot of people, for a lot of kids. The valedictorian makes a speech about the future and everyone at one point gets to throw their caps way up in the air. But the thing is, this is 2020, a year unlike any of us have experienced in our lifetime, much less high school seniors. Coming up, we're going to hear from five LA teens on how they'll remember their last few months of high school. They're up next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Come on, come on. That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh, yeah. Just the way it is. Things will never be the same.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's just the way it is. Oh, yeah.
I see no changes. All I see is racist faces. Misplaced hate makes disgrace to racists. We under. I wonder what it takes to make this one better place. Let's erase the wasted. Take the evil out the people, they'll be acting right.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. For the class of 2020 in Los Angeles, the past few months have been tumultuous. First the pandemic, then the lockdown, every major event canceled, and Zoom became the only way to connect. And then, just as everything started to open back up, unrest took hold of the city. Yeah, it's been a lot. And for seniors in high school, it's meant coming of age and heading off to college under a cloud of a whole lot of uncertainty. We wanted to get a sense of how all of these graduates have been doing, so we reached out to five young people. Daisy Santos from Roosevelt High School, Kira Martin from Immaculate Heart, Catherine Bauer from Campbell Hall, Kyle Jones and Diego Grijalva, both graduating from Mendez High in Boyle Heights. When we spoke last week, they first talked about what the last 3 months have been like and what they miss about not being at school. Daisy Santos starts us off.
On my part, I feel like going to school, you always have to be reminded on tasks you need to do. So it's always in the back of your head and like you're going from class to class and getting piles of work. So you kind of always have that there in the back of your head. But being at home, you just have so much freedom and you get to spend your time however you want. So you kind of forget of your tasks and your responsibilities. So yeah, it's been pretty hard.
So Daisy, being on campus actually helped you stay focused before?
Yeah. Especially like the environment, the class environment, it's like a switch, like a transition. You have to be in another mode and you're focusing on like teacher, the class and everything that's being said.
Diego, what about you in terms of not having the campus environment?
I mean, it's definitely different, you know, like the social like interactions that you have like day to day, even with people who aren't your peers, you know, just still like seeing everybody like moving through the halls, just going to class. And so, I mean, being at home and waking up and then like doing like classes from bed, it's definitely a real difference compared to the social setting of school.
Yeah, I definitely feel the same as Diego, but I also like to add that it's kind of awkward on these calls almost because no one wants to talk over each other. So it's always a blank slate of just the teacher rambling on. Everyone's cameras are off, everyone's on mute. So very easy to get off tasks.
Kyle, I can confirm, because every meeting we've done here at KPCC has been via Zoom, and it's very difficult to know when to talk. You don't want to be rude, but you also want to make your point. So everyone's stopping and starting constantly. A meeting that should last an hour lasts 90 minutes because of the new ways we have to deal with things. So I think, Kyle, everyone understands what you're going through. Kira, what about you? How is not being on campus? And I know Immaculate Heart High School's campus. It is a beautiful campus, just stuck on a hill. So I can imagine not having that view at lunch is probably something you might have been missing.
Yeah, spot on. I do love our campus, and I certainly miss, you know, walking between classes and seeing the purple flowers blooming on the trees. But I think it also is kind of difficult to focus. And like Kyle was saying, like a lot of our classes are seminar-based, but it becomes really awkward when like nobody really knows when to speak and we're talking over each other, then we'll both mute. And it just, yeah, it's been difficult.
Catherine, I know that you're an only child and that you were always hanging out with your friends pre-pandemic. So can you tell us a little bit about what this time has been like for you? Have you felt even more isolated maybe?
Yeah, no, definitely. It's felt very isolated. I am really close with my parents, but they do both work a lot and full time. So definitely not having a sibling or just somebody to kind of keep me from, you know, getting so bored is definitely difficult. And I was spending so much time with my friends ever since I got my driver's license. I've just honestly rarely been home all the time. So it is nice to have some time with my parents, but during the weekdays, it's definitely just, you know, trying to keep myself occupied, to-do lists, baking, reading sometimes, you know, being outside has really helped. So definitely trying to keep myself busy.
Catherine, when you said I'm really close with my parents, but I would have bet that you would have said, but they're really getting on my nerves now. I thought that's where you were going with that.
No, definitely. I mean, we do kind of probably annoy each other, especially because, you know, there's so much tension with what's going on and we all want to get out of the house. But I mean, we have always, you know, I've always been an only child and they're kind of like my best friends sometimes. Mm. So it is nice to have them as a support system through all this for sure.
Now, there's a lot going on in the world following the death of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. Protests have been going on now for 2 weeks. And continue. And there's just been so much information and misinformation out there, images on social media about what's happening. Wondering how have you guys been taking all of this in and everything that's been going on in the country right now? Kira, let's start with you. I know you've actually been to a couple of the protests. What has this time been like for you?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that there's a lot of emotions running high, especially for Black Americans like myself. I have been to a good few protests at this point. Most of them have kept peaceful. But it feels just kind of like a constant stream of news. I'll go to a protest and again, emotions will be high and then I'll come home and I'll look at social media and just every single post, there's something new, there's something that's gone wrong. So it's definitely been a lot to cope with and deal with.
Yeah, it's a lot to go through, especially in the heat of the moment when sometimes the major media sources don't show the full story on the ground. And that's when I believe social media is a really good resource because you see, in some senses, unfiltered, uncensored stuff of the real world. And it's very shocking.
Definitely very difficult just to see this like every day. I usually try not to be on my phone the minute I wake up, but it's definitely like just hanging around throughout the day, like seeing the news, like constantly pop up. So I think that I'm finding myself taking more and more breaks as it just continues. So I'll do the most that I can in terms of signing petitions, donating, even if I have any spare money. But I'm definitely taking breaks when it just becomes too much.
All of you really sound like you got a very good kind of feel for how to manage social media. A lot of adults have no idea how to do this and it drives them crazy. I want to go back to you guys on this. Kira, how do you decide what is real and what isn't and what you allow yourself to consume on social media?
I think it's certainly difficult at times. I find myself trying to make sure that images or posts that are being shared, that they're in correlation with some other ones. But it's also, I find myself trusting news sources less at times, just because I think as Diego or Kyle were saying, they don't always show the full pictures.
Talking to five LA high school seniors, Kira Martin, senior at Immaculate Heart High School, Catherine Bauer from Campbell Hall, Daisy Santos from Roosevelt High School, and Kyle Jones and Diego Grijalva, seniors at Mendez High School. Kyle, you were the one that said, yeah, that the picture sometimes isn't shown in its entirety. So how do you filter that? How do you know where to go and what to do and when to put things down?
I feel like you just know Like, there's something inside you that knows that this is clearly false. Maybe because, like, it's a weirdly low-res picture, or you just see something just off about the video that just doesn't look right. And you just get a sense of what's real or not. But going back to the mass media, I feel like now that we all have phones in our pockets, it's important that we see these videos.
Diego, what about you? What are people your age getting that adults are struggling with when it comes to social media consumption?
I think one of the big things is that kids our age were born with telephones in their hand, as people say. And just because like of them being just so close with technology versus like, I don't know, people who barely got like iPhones, you know, like when they were like in their 20s. I mean, people are tech savvy. It's pretty easy to use the internet, to look at news media on the internet. But I just feel like kids of our generation are raised with a bigger sense of like, don't trust everything on the news, or like, be careful what you put out on the internet, because like they're just raised with it already. So people know that they need to take extra precautions when using the internet. So I think it's definitely has something to do with the way that we're just raised on the internet. It definitely helps us just realize more and more, like Kyle was saying, that we have like this feeling of like what's real, what's not real.
Daisy, what about you? How are you managing the information overload?
Kind of like how everybody else was saying, you just have to make sure like the information you're getting is correct. And if it's fishy, to do some type of research and kind of understand what's actually going on, because a lot of the things that are out there are not true or telling a different side or story. So yeah, I try to always see both sides to it and understand one point or another perspective.
Catherine, what about you? How do you manage this?
You know, a lot of people right now have either conflicting opinions or a very strong similar opinion. And it's really hard not to have that kind of like herd mentality and to go with everybody else on something. But you really do have to think for yourself, and you have to find like the original sources that articles are using. It's kind of like the game telephone when you're little, how, you know, the real source goes to something else and then somebody else keeps talking about that. Somebody else reports on it. So you just really have to find the original stuff and, you know, make your own assumptions on that.
Now, as I've said before, 2020 has really been a roller coaster ride from the very beginning, from New Year's Day almost. Kira, you actually help run a teen crisis hotline, so you've been helping others during this time. What's that been like for you?
I think once everything started, we certainly saw an increase in like anxiety calls or even just, you know, troubles at home. And now that we're all on lockdown, especially, it's really difficult for a lot of us and a lot of teens who've been calling in to cope with. And so I get to see a lot more about how people are coping with the quarantine than just outside my own house.
How did you manage to like just care for yourself during all this?
Yeah. Something that we put a lot of emphasis in is self-care for our listeners and our observers. But it is difficult, especially when you hear so many teens that are going through such a hard time. And then instead of being able to, you know, go outside and go with your friends and get your mind out of a bad space, you're stuck at home. But I've been putting a lot of effort into learning new skills and also catching up on things like reading and baking. Yeah, trying as hard as I can to keep self-care in front of my mind.
Now, you've all gone through this time while still remaining involved in your schools. Kyle, I know you're student body president. Diego, you're involved in the student body. Daisy, you're captain of your school's drill team. Catherine, you started your own club, A Passion for Change. Catherine, let's start off with you on this. Tell us about that group and what's it been like for you guys during this time.
Yeah, so my really good friend and I, we started a club called Passion for Change in our school just to kind of get our community more active with doing, you know, physical service and fundraising and spreading awareness on campus. So for us, kind of our club became like our baby, and we loved it so much and all the time we put into it, and not being able to, you know, close out the year and celebrate and do stuff like that was really difficult. We were going to do a service project like just a few days after school got closed. And so unfortunately, that was canceled. And, you know, it's just really hard that we weren't able to give kids at our school that opportunity. But definitely we're excited because, you know, some of our club members are going to take over next year. And, you know, we're already talking to them about how to go about organization and reaching out to organizations. And that'll definitely be good.
Kyle, what was it like to be student body president pretty much from a screen, like the Wizard of Oz in a way?
Oh, wow. That's an analogy. I think I could have done a better job with outreach. I think our online presence as a whole for leadership has been a very a low one, unfortunately, but it seems like things are getting better by the day. We just successfully launched a car parade last night. Our student body, class of 2020, put in their addresses in our Google Sheets forms so that our teachers and staff could throw a little car parade by going around to different streets where our students live in the Boyle Heights and East LA area. And that was really wonderful to see.
Now, Daisy, I know your drill team's competitions came to an end very suddenly. What was that like for you to gear up and get ready and all of a sudden, no, stop?
So for my competition season, we kind of got four competitions done and over with before quarantine. So we were also looking forward to others that were coming up, like Six Flags, and we were hoping to make more memories and just basically have a fun time with all of our team members.
Now, Diego, you're an athlete. Swimming and cheerleading were in your plans this semester. How did it feel not to have those experiences anymore?
Well, honestly, I mean, it sucked. I mean, that's as like basic as I could put it, because so when I started cheer, this was my first year doing it. We did basically sidelines for the first half, which was cheering at football games, you know, like standard cheerleading stuff. But the second half was competition, which was what I was looking forward to the most. And we did maybe like three small competitions. And then like we were told like, oh, you know, we can't. Like, that's when quarantine hit. And so while that was happening, we were also getting ready to start swimming for the swim season. So I did, like, maybe, like, two swims at the pool that we're training at, and then quarantine hit. So, I mean, seeing these things, like we've been training for and, like, looking forward to, and especially because it's our last year, I know a lot of people are definitely affected by that. Looking for that, like, different, like, thing to fill in that void of being an athlete definitely is hard to do now, like, at home. Like, yeah. I can't really swim in my bathtub.
All right, you're hearing the voices of some of LA's high school class of 2020. Daisy Santos from Roosevelt High, Kira Martin from Immaculate Heart, Catherine Bauer from Campbell Hall, Kyle Jones, and Diego Grijalva, both graduating from Mendez High in Boyle Heights. We just heard how odd it was to spend the last half of your senior year of high school at home, learning, studying, socializing, all on screen. Coming up next, the fun stuff they didn't get to do, like graduating on stage at the Hollywood Bowl and dealing with what's next when no one has any answers. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. The juice, I say the darker the flesh and the deeper the roots. I give my heart to my sister's own welfare. Two pockets, if don't nobody else care. And I know they like to beat you down a lot. When you come around the block, brothers clown a lot. So please don't cry, dry your eyes, never let up. Forgive, but don't forget, girl, keep your head up. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. We've been hearing from graduates of the high school class of 2020, and in our second half of our conversation, I asked them about all the traditions and rites of passage that high school seniors often cherish going into their adulthood, and actually how it feels not to be able to experience some of them, like grad night at Disneyland.
Oh my gosh, I still feel bummed about it because, I mean, I love Disneyland, I love the whole grad night feel, and it's a shame we're never going to experience it. But I'm also quite sad that our seniors are not going to experience our prom, that the prom committee has been planning for a while now, and I guess a physical graduation ceremony too. So it's very unfortunate times, I guess.
Yeah, like I was saying, like, well, for me, I don't really like these huge celebrations that they do. I know that they're, I'm just that type of kid, you know, that like all the spotlight's on me and I don't, it's not my thing. But I know that definitely, like, I would have enjoyed walking up on stage for my grandma or for my parents, because I know they've definitely been there throughout my entire experience of high school and all my learning experience, and moving forward, they'll continue to support me. But I know that it definitely would have been really nice for them to see, like, me walk the stage and, like, pick up my graduation, because they've been putting in that work to help me get there.
Yeah, Diego, when I graduated high school and college, my diploma was in my hand for maybe 2 minutes because my mom immediately grabbed it and put it away. I think it was more for her than it was for anyone else. Daisy, I know that you were still able to have a prom. Was it a virtual prom for you?
Actually, yeah, okay. It wasn't really a prom like for the whole school. Yeah. It was just like a close friends meeting or gathering that we decided to like host, and anybody can come in and we would just spend the evening together listening to music or talking about anything in general, really.
Did you still dress up, corsage, the whole, I mean, did that still happen? You did, okay.
Yeah, some of our friends, we were like, you can dress up if you want, you can be comfortable however you would like. We're not saying you have to go all out, but yeah, some of my friends actually like dressed up. So it was kind of fun.
Did you do it? Did you dress up?
Yeah. I was like, why not? You know, I didn't have the evening, the proper evening for prom, so why not?
Now, Kira, I know Immaculate Heart High School's graduation is always at the Hollywood Bowl. It is a big, big spectacle. You didn't get to do that, right?
Yes, the Hollywood Bowl canceled their entire season, which included us. Yeah, that was a big blow.
You're looking forward. I would imagine. I mean, I would be looking forward to it if that was where my high school graduated. I mean, how much were you looking forward to it? And did you understand, or were you okay because considering the circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, Immaculate Heart really emphasizes that, you know, the Hollywood Bowl, and we have these long white dresses and a bouquet of roses, and we've been practicing, like we were practicing for months before we got shut down. And then suddenly it was like, oh, nope, we're going to be individual at school. We may not, you know, be able to have the same experience again. So disappointing.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Catherine, I know that you were actually really looking forward to a performance with your steel drum band, but I hear that you might have been still able to do it?
Yeah, so definitely one of my favorite programs at Campbell Hall is the steel drum band, which I've been a part of since second semester of eighth grade. Super unique and fun, and we have a concert once a semester. So as a senior, there was three of us in the band, and we were going to have like our hardest semester of music ever. It was going to be super fun. We were going to do it memorized completely, like 8 minutes of music completely memorized. And then of course our concert got canceled, but what was really, really special is our teacher wanted to make sure that we could still have some experience where we could, you know, show off our skills and how great we are as a band. And so he created like the idea of a virtual concert. So basically, we individually recorded ourselves playing our parts, and they musically blended it all together beautifully and had a video editor do a mosaic of us all playing, and they released our virtual concert of our two hardest songs on Saturday. And you know what? That was super special. I'm really, really fortunate that we were able to, you know, celebrate in some way rather than none.
Do you guys feel like your senior year was stolen from you? I mean, I considering the circumstances, I mean, there's nothing anyone could have done, but I'm wondering if you guys feel like your senior year was robbed. Kyle, let's start with you.
Yeah, I do have that feeling. But you know, there's always a college graduation, so.
I think that, yeah, in a sense, it was robbed. But I think I agree with you in the statement that, like, there was nothing that anyone really could have done.
Yeah, I had envisioned a lot of things for senior year, like going to prom, going to graduation, and just taking pictures of my friends and having final moments with them. But yeah, it was all of a sudden, like, it was gone, and I had to adapt to what was happening. So I came to terms with it, but it does suck that this had to happen to class of 2020.
All right, now let's look toward that future. I know all of you have big plans. Daisy, start us off, because I hear that you have an eye on the big screen. Daisy, tell us about what your plans are.
Yeah, I plan to go to UCI and major in drama. Right now, I'm interested in the acting field. I've always have a knack for like acting, and when I was younger, me and my sister would compete and memorize movies from lines, especially Disney movies, and we would just be like, oh, I know more lines than you, and we're just always competing against each other. So yeah, I decided to take that interest and pursue it in college.
And Hollywood is opening up filming, so you might catch a break really quick and make your big break happen in 2020. Now, Kyle, I know I mentioned that you were in student government. I think you still want to continue that in college.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what Fullerton has for me in the fall, and hopefully down the line, law school.
And Diego, I know you have some pretty unique plans for your immediate future. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, I mean, most people definitely don't go into this field of work, but I mean, it's there. I want to go into mortuary science, so I plan to do 2 years or 1 year actually, sorry, here at ELAC to do the basic requirements. And then I'm switching over to Cyprus, get a mortuary degree. What that entails is, you know, working with dead people and dead bodies and preparing them to be buried.
How did you get interested in that?
I suppose luck. So a lot of the times I get my interest through reading, but this time I was listening to a podcast and this woman was explaining her experiences at working as a mortician, and it just kind of struck a chord with me. And I was like, that sounds like something I want to do. And so here I am on the path to becoming a mortician.
Oh, cool. All right, Catherine, and you're headed to USC, Catherine, right?
Yeah, I'll be studying business at USC, and I hope to also mix in a little public policy. I'm really interested in, you know, a lot of the nonprofit organizations I've, you know, worked with my club and my family has been involved with. And so I hope to go into that industry and, you know, kind of make a difference that way.
Kira, what about you? What's next for you this fall?
Things are slightly up in the air because I plan to go to Scotland for university, but the UK has just put in some travel bans and restrictions. So we'll see. It's kind of up in the air for me right now.
Uncertainty, Kira, for you. I mean, you really have uncertainty on your plate. How is that feeling right now, knowing that maybe there's not much to know about your situation?
I think it's certainly worrying at times. Like, I really am so looking forward to actually going to Scotland and being at St. Andrews, and that might not be possible. So I am looking into the possibility of taking a gap year. Hopefully by 2021, all of this will be more cleared up.
Catherine, what about you when it comes to the uncertainty that might be to come?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely super hopeful for freshman year. And of course, we all want the most normal experience we can get, but we have to understand that that's not necessarily possible for anyone right now. And I think we just really have to know that you have to make the best out of every situation, because that's what you really do have control over.
Yeah, there is a lot of uncertainty moving forward. A lot of my peers just said that anything could change. But I think, too, this year will teach all of us to adapt to anything that comes our way and hopefully make the best decisions when the time comes.
All right, now 2020 for sure is going to be a year that we will all remember for the rest of our lives. Impossible to forget what went on this year. If all of you had to sum up your senior year in one sentence or one thought, what would you say? Diego, start us off.
I think I would say unexpectedly bittersweet, but fun.
Kyle, what about you?
2020 would be remembered as the most craziest year, most unpredictable, but the most important year of our lives.
Daisy, how would you put 2020?
I would put it as it is what it is.
Not bad, not bad. Kira, what about you?
I would probably say a year with like crazy amount of uncertainty, but also a lot of enlightenment and growth.
Catherine, you get the last word.
I would definitely say that 2020 was a difficult year, but we can do a lot by showing efforts of love and support during this time for those we really care about.
All right. That was Kira Martin, senior at Immaculate Heart High School in Los Feliz. Daisy Santos, senior at Roosevelt High in Boyle Heights. Catherine Bauer, senior at Campbell Hall. Kyle Jones and Diego Grijalva, both seniors at Mendez High School. Thank you to all five of you, and good luck in your future studies and plans.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, that music you're hearing is Bohemian Rhapsody from Campbell Hall's Steel Drum Band. That's the group high school grad Catherine Bauer is a part of. All right, there have been plenty of protests in and around Hollywood, but that's the physical area of Hollywood. What about the industry that Hollywood represents? Movies, TV, entertainment. What can or should showbiz do to showcase diverse stories on screen and off? That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
City of angels. vehicles in constant danger. South Central LA can't get no stranger. Full of drama like a soap opera. On the curb watching the ghetto bird helicopters. I observe so many homies getting...
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm A. Martinez, and if you're wondering why we've been hearing Tupac going into segments coming out of our breaks, Tupac would have been 49 years old today. The entertainment industry is among the biggest employers in Los Angeles, but despite the rich diversity in this city, the industry is far from racially or ethnically diverse. As the protests in support of Black Lives Matter have continued, one by one, Hollywood studios, talent agencies, and institutions have pledged to do better as it relates to inclusion. But which of their pledges could actually make a difference? Here to talk about it with us is Darnell Hunt, Dean of Social Sciences and Professor of Sociology and African American Studies at UCLA. Professor Hunt, welcome back to Take Two.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure. All right. Let's start with the big picture and then we'll dive into specifics. So in your opinion, could there be a meaningful impact of the protests on Hollywood, the business of show?
Well, you know, there's no guarantee, of course, but this is clearly one of those inflection points in history where the nation is being forced to look at itself and determine the degree to which it's actually living up to its ideals. And I think it's an opportunity for Hollywood to do the same, to look at itself in the mirror and to ask, you know, are we a part of the problem or are we a part of the solution? And if business as usual continues, I argue they're a part of the problem.
Now, every year you put out a Hollywood diversity report and ask the question, are women and minorities getting key jobs in front of and behind the camera? And the answer has often been yes and no. So, Darnell, what are the key reasons why Hollywood has not made hiring more women and more people of color a priority in the past?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's a disconnect of sorts. On the one hand, we've been able to document with our annual Hollywood diversity report that diversity sells. Which makes sense. I mean, 40% of our population, a little bit more than 40% of our population is people of color. Women make up a little bit more than half the population. And the rest of the world, the globe, looks more like America's diversity than it does Europe. So clearly there's a market out there for diverse content. The problem is Hollywood hasn't been structured to make the most of that opportunity. And what I mean there is that the people making decisions at the very top in the executive suites, who run the studios, run the networks, they've been, for the most part, white men who are good at what they do. I mean, they've risen to the top because they've made projects that maybe accurately reflect their experiences and do well in that part of the market. But as the market has shifted, the types of stories we need to tell, they're not the best situated people to tell those stories. And so what they've done is bring in people that they've worked with in the past, they feel comfortable with, as opposed to people who may have a different perspective, a different way of storytelling that would lead to the type of top to bottom change across all elements of the production that we need to see.
And when I think about Darnell, when I think about just Latinos in Hollywood, they're not many out there behind or in front of the camera. And then I think about who's in the crowd. Well, Latinos make up a lot of the people that make up the movie audience. So I always think about, like, wait, how come there's this disconnect there that no one ever seems to talk about? Now, all right, let's talk about specific proposals that have been made. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has said they plan to implement some diversity requirements for Oscar eligibility. So what do you make of that one?
Well, you know, I think that's an important first step. Those who are familiar with our annual Hollywood Diversity Report will see that we've been somewhat critical of the academies, both in film and television, pushing them to take more of a stand on diversity and inclusion. Because after all, they set the standards. The films and TV shows we celebrate are the types of films and TV shows the industry tends to emulate. So to the degree that diverse projects aren't being recognized, there's less of an incentive for the industry to invest in those types of projects. So I like the idea of setting some basic eligibility requirements for films that are going to be considered for Best Picture or for other major awards based on how accurately they reflect America. I mean, I think that's an important step forward. I guess the devil is in the details in terms of getting the right requirements in place, the right standards, but I applaud the effort.
What would you say, though, to someone who says, well, it's just the Oscars. It's subjective. People vote on the Oscars. They vote on what they like. What would be the big deal?
Well, the problem is who is voting on what they like? I mean, we know the membership of the Academy, despite their efforts. They had that 2020 initiative to increase the representation of people of color and women, they still have a ways to go before the membership looks anything like America. The membership traditionally is skewed older and mostly white. And again, people voting on what they like, which are stories that don't often reflect the experiences of diverse people, and therefore creates this vicious cycle by which the things that get celebrated always manage to have a white lead or tell a white story. And because those films make a little bit more money, they get re-released during Oscar season, they get more critical acclaim and attention. There are pressures against making more diverse projects, thereby perpetuating the statistics that we talk about year in, year out.
Now, some TV networks and studios have diversity programs, and shows have diversity hires. Famously, Mindy Kaling was a diversity hire as a writer on The Office. Does your research show that these have had any effect on hires?
Well, you know, certainly, let me back up. It's hard to control for everything. Lots of things have happened over the last 10, 15 years with respect to the diversity we do see. The only thing we can say for sure is we don't see enough of it. If it weren't for these diversity programs that exist, things would probably be a lot worse. That said, they haven't taken us to the promised land because we still have a long way to go. So what we argue in our research, and we released a report back in September of 2019 called By All Means Necessary, Essential Practices for Increasing Diversity and Inclusion in the Hollywood Industry. And MEANS is an acronym that stands for 5 essential practices or strategies that we feel the industry should pursue if it really wants to make a difference, if it really wants to act on this and get beyond just platitudes. And the point of the MEANS acronym is that any single approach isn't sufficient. You need all 5 because we're talking about a multifaceted problem here. And so diversity programs are part of the answer. Structuring in incentives and rewarding people for doing the right thing is another part of the answer. And there are many more. I mean, I can kind of go through the various types of strategies we've talked about. But the point is, it's a longstanding problem that's going to require structural shifts, not just one-offs or tinkering around the margins.
I wish we got to bring you back for a whole hour, Darnell. I think that's going to be the key next time. Darnell Hunt is Dean of Social Sciences and Professor of Sociology and African American Studies at UCLA. Darnell, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for Take 2. If you missed any part of the show today, just head to wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media. We're on Twitter at Take 2. That's at Take 2. I'm there as well at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.